Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Psychoanalysis, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. My name is Philip Lance, and I'm today's host. Today, I'm speaking with Jan Abram and Robert Hinchelwood about their book, published by Routledge in 2018, The Clinical Paradigms of Melanie Klein and Donald Winnicott, Comparisons and Dialogues. And let me introduce our authors. Jan Abram is, looking it up here, I just had it, a training and supervising analyst of the British Psychoanalytic Society and is in full-time private practice in London. Her book, The Language of Winnicott, was published in 1996 and awarded Outstanding Scholarly Book in 1997. And then Bob Hinchelwood is a fellow of the British Society. He's a professor, a prodigious writer. He's the author of a book, The Dictionary of Kleinian Thought. So we have sort of the foremost, I think, Winnicottian and Kleinian sort of expert scholars online with us today to talk about the differences between these two thinkers. So maybe before we get started, I think, Bob, can you say something more about the Dictionary of Kleinian Thought?
Oh, I could say quite a lot. It was published in 1989, quite a long time ago, when I had been doing quite a bit of teaching in a psychotherapy organization and trying to teach Klein, and I realized how much I needed to learn about Klein myself. So the dictionary was the product of quite a lot of teaching that I did and trying to find answers to the clever questions that young students were asking me. So it went down rather well. The dictionary seemed to become quite popular and is now translated into 8 or 9 languages around the world. But that was a long time ago now. It's nearly 30 years. And I passed by the opportunity of doing a new edition just a few years ago and handed over the project to an organization called the Melanie Klein Trust. And you may know that there is now a new Dictionary of Kleinian Thought, came out about 3 years ago, which is a new edition largely based on my work. There you are, as a quick rundown of what the dictionary is.
Yeah, so for years I've had two books on my shelf right next to each other. Jan's book, The Language of Winnicott, has always been right next to the new Dictionary of Kleinian Thought. Whenever my eye fell on this new dictionary, I always thought Hinchelwood. And it was only just now when I had pulled it out, I thought, oh, I found out, you know, Elizabeth Bott Spilius and several other authors. This is based on your book. But well, let's start talking about this book. And maybe Jan could tell us how this book came to be.
Okay, I'll start off with that. Well, I would like to just let you know that Bob's book that he's just been describing actually happened to be the first psychoanalytic book launch I went to in 1989. And Bob had actually been my teacher in the 80s. And it was definitely an inspiration for me when I got Language of Winnicott together. And for similar reasons to Bob, you know, I wanted to write something that would be useful for me. And it was, I was delighted that it was useful for others as well. But so there's quite a continuity between Bob and I in terms of our interest in defining and discussing different models, different theoretical models. And although Language of Winnicott it's been sort of organized in a different way from Bob's book. Bob's book was definitely an inspiration for me during that book. So when I went to University of Essex as a visiting professor, on behalf of, as it were, it's a post that got set up between Essex and the British Psychoanalytical Society. I was very pleased that Bob was there, and I suggested doing a workshop and having a dialogue on the different paradigms. And that's really how the book started, from a workshop. I was really pleased that Bob agreed to do the workshop. We enjoyed it, and it was extremely interesting, and the audience enjoyed it too. And then we gave another workshop in Poland, in Warsaw, in fact, a couple of years later. And it just seemed the most natural thing in the world to try and find a way of making this a book.
Okay. And a fascinating book it is. And I want to ask Bob about the controversial discussions, because I think that historical event sort of provides a background to this book. I think Klein and I guess when people think of the controversial discussions, they think of Anna Freud versus Melanie Klein. But I think, where does Winnicott fit into that? And Bob, can you give us a little background there?
Yes, it was very much a discussion of controversies between Anna Freud and Melanie Klein that had been going on since 1926. The controversial discussions were set of four papers produced by Kleinians and torn down by Anna Freudians over a period of 18 months in the British Society. Where did Winnicott come in that? I don't think you should ask me, because I read all those scientific papers and all those discussions while I was writing the dictionary. And I don't recall very much of Winnicott in any of that. It was in 1943, 1944, during wartime, and I think a lot of the members of the Psychoanalytical Society were away in the military, and they were not regular attenders at the at these controversial discussions. But I really don't have a recollection of Winnicott contributing very much. And I think I would, because I've always been interested in Winnicott. Now, I think, Jan, do you know what Winnicott did in to contribute to the controversies?
During that period, yes. He did, according to Pearl King and Ricardo Steiner, in that huge, marvellous work they did on the controversial discussions, they said that he did attend every meeting except one, evidently. But later on, in his later work, he says they left him cold, those controversies. You can see where he contributed, but in quite a sort of, at that time, a minor way. And of course, it wasn't until 1945, the end of the discussions, when he first presents his primitive emotional development paper, and that's where he really says, right, I'm going to go for it now, and I don't care whether this is the party line or not. I just have to think about what my clinical practice inspires in me. And I often say, and I think most people would agree, that that's where he really starts his original way of leaving the debates behind and getting on with his own work. And I think that's the beginning of the development of his new paradigm.
Maybe I'm thinking what I'm trying to get at with this question is more, so did the controversial discussions kind of evolve from Klein versus Anna Freud to Klein versus Winnicott? Or is that where there's more tension today in today's world?
My sense is that they didn't evolve anywhere, and the controversial discussions were, in one sense, a terrific failure, because they did not bring the British Society together at all. The British Society came to a tripartite arrangement where for decades people really hardly engaged with each other's work at all. It was a very peculiar time in the early 1940s, during wartime. Nearly all the psychoanalytical societies in Europe had disappeared, and the British was the only one left, apart from a small one in Sweden and a small one in Switzerland. And so it was desperately important, I think, for the British society to stay together and remain a robust organisation. And it did stay as a robust organisation, but not in any coherent theoretical way. So I don't think they evolved, and they certainly, as well, I say certainly, but in my view, it was not. They did not represent the origins of the Klein and Winnicott partnership and. Well, whatever we call it, I hesitate to call it disagreement because, in my view, Klein and Winnicott were in greater agreement than in disagreement.
Let's come back to that because I guess I kind of have my opinion about that. But I know you call them a partnership, which is great. But let's carry on with a question for Jan about how is this book put together? Sort of what's it structured?
Okay. You don't want me to add to this this question about controversial discussions?
Oh, sure. Please do.
Just a couple of minutes because really the outcome, you know, as Bob says, I think it was a crisis in the late 30s. Melanie Klein was, and I learned this from Bob, about to leave, wasn't she, Bob?
No, she was about to leave.
She was about to leave the British Society.
She certainly thought that Anna Freud should leave. She was cross with Ernest Jones for inviting the Freud family to come to England. It seemed a rather ungenerous sentiment.
That's why. Yeah, there was a lot of tension. But my understanding is, you see, at that time, it was my heroine is Marjorie Brearley, who sent what's called the armistice letter to Melanie Klein, really begging her to talk about it without the personal assaults, because there were some really personal stuff that went on in some of those debates and scientific meetings. And I'm not sure I would see it as a failure, but it was the controversial discussions. I think the conclusion was I wouldn't say it was tripartite. I would say it was you know, the A and B training. The Anna Freudians were the B training and the Kleinians were the A training. And then there was this whole load of indigenous psychoanalysts who said, we don't want to be A or B training. And they became known as the middle groupers, but by Edward Glover, one of the Freudians. But in fact, I hate this term, middle groupers. They were analysts who didn't want to split and wanted to remain neutral, as it were. But what we did get is, I think, Bob, an evolution of Freudian theory and an evolution of Kleinian theory, and the independents were somehow in between, and Winnicott certainly was one of those, but he didn't want that system of different trainings. I just thought that was quite important to get in.
Okay.
And the other thing, going back to your question, Philip, about how is the book put together, you see, the thing is, Winnicott, it's true, was seen by a lot of Freudians and still is to some extent as a Kleinian, because Melanie Klein did name him as one of her training analysts at the beginning of the controversial discussions. And in a way, in 1945, that's what he was saying. He was dropped by her, in fact. And that was partly because he couldn't get what she needed in terms of theories ready for the discussions, but neither could John Rickman. Pearl King said they were very independent public schoolboys who couldn't be kind of controlled. And of course, I can understand that Melanie Klein did need some kind of control over how they were going to debate these certain issues that Edward Glover and others were really criticizing her for. So she was under a lot of pressure during that time. And I think it could be argued that actually the outcome has been very creative for both Kleinians and Freudians and independents.
Okay, and can you say a little bit about the structure of the book, just briefly, sort of how it's put together?
Yeah, we after the workshop, we really decided that we evolved certainly this structure, didn't we, Bob? So it's five parts. The first part, basic principles of our respective authors. So just we aimed to do short chapters because the dictionaries and all sorts of other literature is out there, but what we saw as the basic principles. And after those first two chapters, then we have a dialogue. In part two, we felt early psychic development was very important to look at and look at the differences there. And after that, we have a summary and another dialogue and so forth. Part three is the role of the external object. Part four, the psychoanalytic concept of psychic pain. And part five, practice and theory. We decided that we should let Melanie Klein, Bob wrote the first chapter of each part because obviously Winnicott was junior to her. And the other thing is he was really in dialogue with her. I have said in several writings that I think without Freud and Klein, we wouldn't have a Winnicott. Even though his paradigm is different and distinct, it was because he was in discourse with those two different paradigms, in my view, the Kleinian and the Freudian.
Okay, and what you mentioned this, I think that you actually emailed each other back and forth at times to create this dialogue aspect of the book, which I found really useful and entertaining even. Sometimes it even seemed like you were getting a little testy with each other. And I'm wondering, Bob, that work to create an engaging sort of read, am I perceiving,
I what, friends,
you know, are
yes.
you guys still friends?
I think we couldn't have written the book if we hadn't been good friends and if there hadn't been a respect for each other. And indeed, if we hadn't respected each other's particular person. I mean, I did respect Winnicott's work, and I think Jan respected Klein's. So, I think we were very careful to try to sustain a respectful quality to the dialogue. It's true. You're absolutely right, Philip, that you can't have extended discussions. Yes, they were all discussions by email. You can't have extended discussions without feeling provoked sometimes or feeling irritated that your point hasn't got across or something like that. That's inevitable. I don't know if your comment a little mad with each other. I don't know if that's an exaggeration, but, you know, any communication between two people has its ups and downs. I think we did rather well to sustain a friendship through all these dialogues. How long did it take us, Jan? It must have been a year plus that we were working on these dialogues. I don't remember exactly how long.
Yes, I think
a good 6 months.
It was a good six months,
wasn't it? Fellow periods.
Yes,
But yes, you're interested in how we did it, and I think that's I think it's a remarkable achievement that we made, Philip, that we were able to manage this dialogue together without falling out in a way that our predecessors and ancestors did. We were doing this on the basis of decades, 60, 70 years of disharmony between Klein and Winnicott. And I can't say we put that to rest, but we had it very much in mind, I think, and did try to be careful with that.
Yeah. I'm having a little fun with you, partly because I recognize that in some ways it really is a model of, I think the British aren't you guys famous for your sort of cordiality and courtesy, and it's actually beautifully done. So I want to for our listeners, help them understand, begin some of the basic differences between the paradigms, maybe by using the idea of the infant, the Winnicottian infant and the Kleinian infant. They're two different infants. And to kind of mix this up a little bit, instead of having Jan do the Winnicottian infant, why don't you each describe the others? So like Bob, can you talk about what is the foremost about the Winnicottian infant?
I think this is a really cruel way of going about it. But perhaps it's an interesting idea. It's an interesting idea. I want to say, first of all, that Winnicott and Klein were on the same lines, really. They were both absolutely clear that there's something going on in the mind that's at a deeper level than the unconscious, neurotic, the level of repression. They were both clear about that, that there were experiences which perhaps resurface in some adults as psychotic experiences. And I think both were clear that this was something to do with the formation of the ego, the development of the ego itself, as opposed to working out the conflicts that get into an already functioning ego, the Oedipal conflicts in particular. And I think this is where they were very much along the same lines. I think this must have been what attracted Winnicott in the 1920s to Klein. I think this was their common... the common factor, the common denominator between them, what they thought was going on at that deeper level. You know, Melanie Klein is always talking about the deeper levels because she came to emphasize this deeper level. What did Winnicott think was going on? As I understand it, and I have to say, I learned a great deal from the dialoguing with Jan about this. But as I understand it, Winnicott thought that the infant does not have a properly functioning ego in that it recognizes itself as having a self, having an experience of itself as separate from the rest of the world and other people in the world. And in particular, the infant does not recognize the separateness of the caregiver upon whom, in an objective way, the infant is completely dependent. The infant is at birth in a state of, maybe one would call it a delusion, but I think Winnicottians call it an illusion, that the infant is almighty and is providing entirely for itself. I think that's the really important difference that comes out, and I really stress that from the understanding that I've got from Jan. There you are, Jan. What about
okay,
the Kleinian infant?
Jan, are you there? Can you tell us about the
yes, I'm
how
so
you
here.
See the Kleinian infant?
Well, in fact, in our first workshop, this is really where we were recognizing how different the two infants are. Do you remember, Bob, you saying that the Kleinian infant was screaming blue murder? I think that was your expression. And as I understand it, you see the paranoid schizoid position that Klein developed after she had developed the notion of the depressive position. I think I'm right in thinking in getting that. It's really the early primitive psychic moment of the infant, which is terrifying and murderous. And the infant has to go through a huge amount of angst, one could say, which I think that Melanie Klein did recognize the role of the environment, but the role of the environment rather mitigated what the baby had to go through, rather than in Winnicott's frame, if the mother was good enough, they didn't have to go through this murderous rage. That came later, but they didn't have to go through it right at the very beginning.
Well, then let's pick up from that blue murderous blue rage. I had another question about how each one of these theorists handle instinct, and it's. But I think maybe we can keep that in mind and come back to it if necessary. But let's take off from this idea of a baby who's in that moment of screaming murderous rage, because it gets to a difference between Klein and Winnicott on what hate and aggression is all about. And I don't know, maybe Jan, you could say a little bit about, as a Winnicottian, what are you seeing in the infant who's screaming in rage? What's going on there?
Well, quoting Winnicott, it would be the edge of unthinkable anxiety. But the edge means that if there is a mother who is identified at a very profound level with the infant never actually has to fall forever, never has to actually experience primitive agony, as he puts it. She is the holding environment that means he never has to go through that. And she, in that sense, is his ego, if we call the baby he, for the differentiation between the mother and the baby. And so it would depend on how the environment mother is coping with her feelings with this newborn infant, and how she's handling and holding and managing the infant's anxiety, because it's not as if there are no anxieties at that time, but there's no intentional murder. There's no, you know, for Winnicott, there's no death instinct. There's life instinct, and there's communication at a very primitive level. So if the baby could speak, the baby would be saying, help me, I need some help here to organize what's happening to my body out in the world. Now I'm outside of the womb. Something along those lines. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so the baby's screaming maybe because it hasn't been held well enough, and that's the origins of this experience, horrific experience the baby feels like it's going through. So I may be putting words in your mouth, but let's move to Bob. And then Bob, what do you see as from a Kleinian perspective in the screaming baby?
Well, very much the same as what Jan has been saying, that the baby inevitably meets frustrations and a reality that doesn't provide something or other that makes it feel insecure. The baby has needs, and mother does her best to work out what they are and to care for the baby. and mother doesn't always get it right. That's the reality, and the baby has to accommodate both a mother who's holding very well, looking after, giving satisfaction. The baby then feels satisfaction and feels more than just satisfaction, but feels there is a somebody who is benevolent. So it is more than just a feeling of satisfaction. But the other side of it holds as well, that things don't always go right and the baby feels not satisfied, and something comes from the baby which says it's not just I'm not satisfied, it's somebody who actively wants me to be dissatisfied, at least at the very early stages in the first few weeks or months. These are symmetrically opposite kinds of reactions. That would be something of the a Kleinian view. There is, as Susan Isaacs put it, a fantasy about the object and what the object is like, whether the object is good and benevolent, whether the object has malevolent intentions. There's a polarity there. You quickly slid over the thing about instincts, and I would try and make it quick, but Klein didn't know anything about instincts. She was not a biologist. She was not a doctor. She was not educated in a scientific way, and I don't think she really understood the way that the term instinct was used. I'm sure she never read Fechner and his idea of psychophysics and so on that was so influential for Freud. So what Klein was talking about were these experiences of the baby that seemed to come from some sort of innate predisposition. And I don't think one can talk about them as instincts in the sense that classical psychoanalysis does, that they are a source of energy that drives various wishes and satisfactions. She did not have a theory of energy. She never, in any of her writings, talks about psychic energy or about the economic model. It just wasn't part of her conceptual thinking. What she did, what she was interested in, was the kind of narratives that the baby seems to inherently bring out when it has its various experiences at the hands of its caregiver. And as you will probably know, Susan Isaacs converted this from instinct theory into an object relations theory by saying instincts are mentally represented as unconscious fantasies.
Okay, so let me see if I can kind of hear what I hear from this is, so in Melanie Klein's paradigm, the infant's having experience, felt bodily experiences, and it always has, there's a concurrent fantasy going on about to you an object and a subject, or a you and a me doing something to each other, and that's an innate way of experiencing the world through this fantasy of two objects relating to each other. And that's what she, so that's innate, but that's not what we think of it as an instinct in the way Freud and biologists think of instincts.
It's quite different, yes. I would say it's quite different from Freud's view of based on 19th century physiology, Fechner, as I mentioned.
Yeah. Okay. And so then let's ask Jan. Did Winnicott rely much on instinct theory?
Well, you see, I think that Winnicott certainly was. Really, he had a classical Freudian analysis with James Strachey, and he did follow Klein's work. But in terms of the infant and what Bob has just said about the splitting that the infant does at the very beginning in Kleinian theory, that's not happening in the Winnicottian baby. And actually, there's no such thing as frustration for the Winnicottian baby in the good enough environment, because according to Winnicott, there's no ego. You have to have an ego functioning in order to be frustrated. And the ego is enlisted. It's the mother's ego that is enlisted by the infant. Whereas in Klein, as I've understood it from Bob and others, that, you know, the baby is object relating from the beginning. And there does seem to be a suggestion of the separation between object and subject. Whereas for Winnicott, there's a merger. And there's an environment mother and an object mother that gradually, through the course of time and the way in which the baby has been held or not, will evolve into the capacity to perceive me as distinct from the not me. And that's when the baby starts to reach the development of the capacity for concern. So it is it's quite a different language and a different way of thinking about the very, very early stages. There isn't a persecutory object in the baby that has been well enough held.
All right. Well, let's move on to this topic that's come up a little earlier about, can these paradigms be integrated? Can a clinician work with both of them, or do you have to pick kind of one or the other? And I'll say that sort of my humble opinion, talking to experts, and I'm sort of at the beginning of all this, but sometimes when I'm in a consulting room, I don't think they can be. It seems like you have to go with one direction or the other, or things get confused. But how do we, each of you, think about this question? And let's see, maybe start with Bob.
Yes, okay. Yes, I think there's a risk in these sorts of discussions of polarizing and that emphasizing what the differences are. And I first of all want to say that I think the biggest thing is the similarities that Klein and Winnicott were both interested in these very early moments of the fragility of the ego. Then I wouldn't want to dismiss the differences. So I think that Kleinians and Winnicottians are looking in the same sort of area for what sort of experiences they are left over from this very early or the deeper layer, as Klein called it. I think there are significant differences. Whether it's different that Klein used the idea of a death instinct and Winnicott didn't, I'm not sure, because I think the idea of an instinct gets very confused when we think about Klein's unconscious fantasies, and it was really established by Susan Isaacs in the controversial discussions that we should think about the unconscious fantasies and what sort of experiences they produce. What does seem to me as an important difference, and that one probably has to take a decision on whether which point of view one agrees with, and that is, as Jan was saying, Klein was of the view that the infant from the beginning was aware of some separation, some quality of separation from an object other than itself, which then may get seen in terms of the narratives of these unconscious fantasies, whereas Winnicott saw things in terms of a merger, or he's thought the infant saw things in terms of a merger, and that there is not really a capacity to distinguish a self from other. Those are two incompatible points of view, and one has to probably decide which one accepts. Maybe on good grounds, maybe just on grounds that one belongs to a group, a particular group, or not. But one can't believe both of those things, that the infant is born with an ego and an ego boundary, and the infant is also born in a state of merger with its surrounding world. So, yes, that's my thought about how we use these things.
Yeah, and maybe you pick one or the other, but maybe both of them can work, and good clinicians make both of the paradigms work quite well, even though they're based on some different theoretical ideas. But Jan, what are your thoughts about this question of the compatibility of the paradigm?
Yeah, I think it's very, very interesting, because it is so much for me about the use of an object, really, the use of a theory. And I think, you see, if I think about Klein's work on the paranoid schizoid position, it's absolutely brilliant. And I can feel it from time to time with certain patients on the couch going through a particular phase. And it's almost theory in vivo, you know, with certain patients. And where I completely disagree with her is that she saw that as being evidence that this was early psychic development. But for me, and this obviously is me following Winnicott, it's evidence of the failure of the early psychic environment that causes that paranoid schizoid moment. It's not a universal stage of development. And I think that's where Bob and I would disagree, which is fine. I mean, that we don't claim to be the same. And we're not necessarily arguing forcefully for one model or the other. It's just that we disagree about that. Now, the question, the very interesting question then is, as you're indicating, is what difference does that make in the consulting room? And that's where we come to technique. And I think you can make use of different theories, but how do you manage these when you talk to your patients? And what do you do with interpretations? And what do you do with listening? And, you know, it's listening to one's own countertransference, a concept that Klein was quite skeptical of. But for me, it's in the consulting room. It's listening to how I'm feeling as that patient is going through a very particular phase, and what is going to be the most helpful thing for that patient at any given moment. And of course, there are lots of clinical examples. We'd need to go to clinical examples, really, to start really unpicking the differences. And as Bob says, we might end up seeing that we have different approaches, but actually in the consulting room, we might be working in a very similar way.
I'm going to start winding us down, because I know Bob has to get off to a theater, a date there in England. But I was going to ask a question about the myths. I think that there's myths about Kleinian, the Kleinian paradigm, and there's myths about the Winnicottian one. And you help through this book to expose those myths. But maybe I'll finish by asking, since you've done workshops on this, and it seems like such a relevant and practical field for clinicians, are you planning on doing more workshops in other parts of the world, or how are you planning to continue to work together to develop the work of this book?
Yes, we are. I think Jan can tell you about some of the discussions we've been having just today.
Yes, go ahead, Bob.
Oh, I was thinking you could say something about the discussions we have been turning over in our minds today, I mean, before podcast?
Yes, well, we've already done two workshops on Bion and Winnicott, one in Poland again. And we do feel that there's a lot of interest in this kind of book, especially, as you've pointed out, Philip, the comparisons and the dialogues. And we feel that this is a good paradigm for future books of dialogues, and a good template. And so we are in the process of now getting a synopsis ready on Bion and Winnicott. And we're hoping to be talking to Routledge about a series of clinical paradigms of different authors with different clinicians, different well-known clinicians, that different contemporary authors would be interested in dialoguing on. So this is our preliminary plan at the moment.
Yes, we're trying to develop a different kind of controversial discussion from what happened in the
A more successful one. Yeah. Well, I understood Bob was sort of semi-retired, but based on this ambitious sort of, it doesn't sound like it's going to last long.
You got to do something in your retirement. This is
okay. Well, I so enjoyed this book. I think a lot of our listeners will too. And I'm glad we got through this podcast, because when the first time we started it, suddenly it dropped off. And I think it's because it was at the moment that England beat, who was it in the World Cup?
Sweden.
England. Yeah. Something happened to the internet and it all went haywire. So we had to start over. So, but now we've concluded it seemingly successfully. So thank you so much, Bob and Jan, Bob Hinchelwood and Jan Abram, for talking to me today about your book. Let me read the title. The Clinical Paradigms of Melanie Klein and Donald Winnicott, Comparisons and Dialogues. So you've been listening to me, Philip Lance, here at the New Books in Psychoanalysis. And check out our website and feel free to email me with your comments and questions. Thanks for listening.